Hello everyone and welcome back to the Nutrition Nourishment Podcast, a podcast where I talk with my guests through their nutrition journeys. I'm Amelia and your host of the Nutrition Nourishment Podcast. I am a registered associate nutritionist with a BSc in food science and nutrition, and I'm currently studying my MSc in clinical and public health nutrition. Nothing which is said on this podcast should be taken as personalised nutritional advice. If you would like nutrition advice, you can contact a registered nutritionist or dietitian or your GP. Other resources available to you include the NHS and the BDA websites. Now, let's get on with the podcast. For our last episode of the first half of season 3 of the podcast, we have a little bit of a different episode. This is the journey not from a nutritionist or a dietitian or a student in these areas, but a leader. Today, it is a pleasure to be joined by Mark Hollingsworth, CEO of the Nutrition Society. While not a nutritionist, Mark has a career of leadership behind him, from 16 years in the RAF, obtaining his MBA from the Open University, to working with non-charitable organisations, which led him to his role in the Nutrition Society. Mark shares with us today the highs and lows of his journey, along with some great leadership and career advice. Welcome to the Nutrition Nourishment Podcast, sharing our journeys. Hello, yep. Mark, how are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you so much for joining me. It is an honour to have you on, and I'm so excited to learn a little bit more about your journey and hear more about your advice within nutrition. But first, would you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so Mark Hollingsworth, I'm the CEO of the Nutrition Society based in London, currently working from home in the Suffolk countryside. I joined as CEO just over 6.5 years ago, and a bit of a varied career before then. I started out in the Royal Air Force and then into the charity sector. But I guess my claim to fame, if I can call it that, is I was the child least likely to succeed at science at school, according to my old school report. And now I found myself surrounded by the most amazing scientists and nutritionists. So that's kind of funny.
Yeah. It definitely just tells you how far people can come. And when you've got a passion or a love for doing something, anything can be possible.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you'd had a bit of a varied career before you joined the Nutrition Society 6.5 years ago. So let's go back a little bit to that beginning of your personal journey. What first attracted you to become part of the Royal Air Force?
I think it started with the idea of a military career. First of all, my schooling, my upbringing lent itself, I guess, to a vocation in that way. Sport was a big thing. History, risk-taking, adventure, those were all the things that I grew up with. And then when you look at the military, it kind of offers that lifestyle for you. And it is a 24-hour-a-day, 365-day-of-the-year commitment. And that's what I was very much looking for. Added to that, of course, is their reputation for training, particularly in leadership and management. And even in those early days, leadership was a particular fascination of mine. So it seemed the logical choice. Then you just have to choose between the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force. And the Air Force just turned out to be a really good fit, more in terms of values. I mean, all the armed forces have similar values, but the RAF was just a little bit more of a technical approach, as opposed to the Army, which is, of course, very physical, and the Navy, which is more isolated because of the nature of being at sea. The Air Force was kind of in the middle, and that kind of 1940s fighter pilot spirit still lives on, which was a fabulous attraction.
It's so interesting to hear about your experience within the RAF. Personally, not something that I know so much about, so it's really great to hear that from you. You mentioned there that you grew up with a passion with sports and adventure, and that led you into the RAF. Do you think those passions, as well as your experience within the RAF, rose any interest within nutrition, or did that come a little bit later?
I think that came a little bit later. I mean, in the military, particularly on exercises and in combat, food was next to ammunition. Food was the most important thing. So you all had a really active interest in food. And I suppose my only touching on food in those 16 years, I was a bit of an expert in jungle warfare. I lived in Belize for quite a long time.
Wow.
And spend a lot of time in the jungle. So in those survival situations, I've eaten snakes and crocodiles and all kinds of bugs and insects.
It sounds like you're really experiencing the cuisine of where you were living. And I think that's amazing. What was the thing that you most enjoyed when you were trying all these different foods?
Alligator tail. It is the closest in taste and texture to lobster you can imagine. It was wonderful.
Fantastic. So you just mentioned you were in the RAF for 16 years. So you've kind of given us a quick insight into those 16 years, which must have been a huge part of your life. But coming a little bit forwards to, you mentioned the charity sector, which you did after the RAF. Can you speak to us a little bit about how that came about?
Yes. Well, when you join the RAF, it's a 16-year engagement. And at the 16-year point, if you've reached the rank called the beginnings of senior ranks, so squadron leader, then you are allowed to stay to the age of 55 without gaining any other rank or qualification. So you're at 16, it's an option point. And it's quite challenging because you could be on a good course of career work in the Air Force. But at the same time, you've only been in for 16 years. Do I leave then and start a second career at that mid-age point? Or do I stay in a secure environment and leave at 55 and try and start another career then? And I just finished an MBA, my master's degree, through the Open University. And that had opened my eyes to all kinds of interesting opportunities. And I made that decision that it's best to leave and start again. But then the question is, what do I do, you know, after 16 years in the military? And interestingly, the kind of ethos of the military is about service and duty. And I couldn't see myself with that upbringing going into the corporate world. And the nonprofit sector, the charity sector, seemed a really good fit. And one of my case studies on my MBA was into Save the Children as a charity. So I learned a lot about the charity sector. It seemed very attractive. And I was in Canada at the time and stayed there for some time and held a number of charitable positions, getting more and more experienced. And then, frankly, if I can be candid with you, I burnt out. I hit a wall and difficult in a way to talk about what that feels. But I've been working since I was 16. And then I just didn't want to go to work anymore. My amazing new Canadian wife, who was on the kind of trajectory of her career at the time, she was just been made vice president of the Heart Foundation. We agreed that I would take a sabbatical, and I'd been offered the chance to teach at the university. They wanted a course on introductory leadership skills. It was still an interest of mine, of course. So I got the chance to research, to write my own curriculum and teach part-time. So over a couple of years, it was great. I got my head back together. I got excited about leadership again. And then at the end of that period, desperate to get back into a leadership role, but also missing England, because in 25 years, I'd been out of England for about 18 of those years. So we both moved back. My Canadian wife had dual citizenship because her parents were British. So we moved back together, and along came the Nutrition Society. Well, it wasn't quite as simple as that, but it was the right place at the right time. Yeah. And it was the right role, although it didn't seem it at the time, but it is now by far the best thing I've ever done.
You mentioned the right place at the right time, but it seems that you've done a lot of work to getting to the right place at the right time. And as well, I wanted to say thank you for your honesty and sharing your experience when it got hard, because I think it's so important to let people know that everyone has our struggles and it is okay. I just wanted to ask you quickly, I know it's jumping back into your journey a little bit, but about your MBA at the Open University and about your exploration of NGOs at that time.
Yes, well, the MBA, the foundations of it are very broad because it starts with strategy and principles of management. And then after you've put all of that groundwork in place, you can then select modules to look at different aspects in mind. So I looked at strategic human resource management because people are obviously going to be a big part of any leader's future. So I wanted to know more about that. But I knew nothing at all about marketing. And I knew that marketing out of the military was going to be important, understanding brands and advertising and price and product and all of those kind of things. And I was very surprised then when we started studying marketing to be pretty much taken towards the nonprofit sector. And one of those case studies was an NGO. And it was a story of how an NGO had always recruited from within for their senior leadership team, decided to turn the other way and bring in somebody from the corporate sector to become CEO. And it caused all kinds of problems at the time. And this individual transformed the NGO. He took a huge salary cut, kept most of the staff on, brought in a few others, but turned it around completely and turned it into that global multi-million pound organization we know today. And I looked at that and thought, that's exciting. Can you imagine that it must be so rewarding, because Save the Children was having an impact, of course, on the front line of charitable work all over the world. So that's what kind of sparked my interest.
That sounds amazing. I can hear in your voice the inspiration that you felt whilst doing that. So coming out of the RAF and going into the charity sector, what experience and work were you doing?
Well, first of all, it was really difficult. So I know many of your listeners will be at early stages of their careers. I just want to reassure you that even after a career in the military, I was unemployed for nearly 6 months. I thought it'd be easy. Here I am, I'm in Canada, I speak English, I've got a master's degree, all this experience in leadership and management, and nothing. And it is difficult. You get down to almost the last couple of $100s, thinking this is never going to end. But I'd been doing networking through volunteering as a way of finding a new career. And one of those places I'd been volunteering, without letting them know that I was panicking and the money was running out, one of the board of directors phoned me one day and said, "You mentioned once you were looking for a job. Are you still looking? Because I'm on another board and we think you'd be a good fit." And bang, I landed my first job in Canada. So that was in crime prevention, kind of a community program. So I went from a military command of 110 people and a probably £45 million budget to a office of three people with £200,000 a year budget. And I had to fundraise every penny of that £200,000. It was a fantastic experience, although terrifying. And I've never lost that. My staff think I'm overly obsessed, but I'm obsessed with cash flow, the value of a pound, looking after people, getting the most out of volunteers because I couldn't afford to hire anybody. So I spent a few years doing that, and then I got headhunted. You start to build a reputation at all the tables turn. So then I went into fundraising and marketing, which was great for a children's charity, then to the Heart Foundation of Canada, where I became vice president again of fundraising, but for a huge chunk of Canada. And then I moved over to Winnipeg, which is right in the middle of Canada, and became executive director of the Human Resources Association. So registrar of certifying people to requalify and organizing all of their qualifications. So a bit of everything in not so much frontline charity work, but it just shows the breadth of opportunities in NGOs. There's a lot of management issues and society issues that go on behind that.
Really interesting. And I think you highlighted there the breadth of opportunities within the charity sector and within nutrition, and I guess when they come together as well. I think what I learned from, as you were talking about your journey and your experience on it, is to really keep on trying, keep on pursuing, keep on, I think you said, networking through volunteering. And I thought that was really interesting and important point to share.
Yeah, and that concept of, I call it giving before you receive, is so tough. You know, when I came back to England, back in the beginning of 2014, having been out of the country so long, my network was almost non-existent. I had a few old military friends I could call. And again, I went 4 or 5 months. I must have applied for over 30 key roles. I didn't even get a single reply to those. And that's, again, now I've got, not only have I got my military experience and my MBA, I've now got all my Canada experience. Mm-hmm. And it's still difficult to get a job, not even get a job, but even get a telephone call back. And then I had one of those pivoting moments again when I thought, how did I do it last time? Well, last time I volunteered. So I contacted my old school friend who I've known since we were about three, who's CEO of a charity here in Suffolk, and said, "Do you need any help? Could I come and just hang out and do some work for you?" And he said, "I really need somebody to strategically look at my fundraising because we're in trouble." And then I was able to put on my CV, consultant on strategy, the name of that charity. And then suddenly you start getting the callbacks, and the Nutrition Society job came along. I accepted that, but it is difficult, again, when you're under pressure, as you are and others are, when the money is running out, when you don't know what's going to happen, and keep giving and giving and giving. And eventually somebody will return that kindness and that commitment. But when you're in the thick of it, it is so difficult. I have sympathy for everybody, and it drives my team wild that when we hire somebody, I insist on writing back to everybody who applied for the job to tell them why they didn't get it. And they say, "You don't have to do that." I said, "I don't have to do it, but I've been there. Mm-hmm. I know how soul destroying it is." And if you get no feedback, that's just awful. Those people have put a CV together. They've been perhaps even been to the interview. and they haven't got the job, you can't just knock them aside and carry on. You've got to rebuild their confidence some way. Because often it's the narrowest of margins when you interview six people for a job. All of them can do the job, otherwise you wouldn't be interviewing them. You're looking for that little extra. What else can they bring to the team? And it's those kind of fine margins that make you get a job or not get a job. And often you've got no control over that because you don't know what's in my head.
I have to say, giving feedback to all of your applicants is an amazing thing to do. I have been in the position where I have received feedback and I haven't. And getting even just a few lines has been the most valuable thing to me, because then I've taken on that advice and I've applied to another job and I've been able to get those other jobs because I've taken on the advice. I think one of the pieces of advice I received was, make your application really stand out. So you've told me that you've done this, but you haven't made it easy for me to access to get to that piece of writing. So now everything that I send, all my cover letters, I hyperlink in, I attach copies of my work just to make it easy for the person who's receiving my application just to be able to click on it. And receiving that one piece of feedback has made a huge difference. So thank you for doing that for other people as well.
Well, it's going to make their life easier. It's going to make potentially my life easier because they'll remember it. And I tell the story that I don't think many people believe, that if I get 100 applicants for a job, I will probably save that to my train ride home in the evening, which is 60 minutes. So I've got 60 minutes to look at 100 CVs because I've got many other things that I need to be doing. So each of those CVs is going to get less than a minute. So if what I'm looking for is, as you say, is not in that first half of that first page, and I can't find it easily, you go to one side. It's a bit of a numbers game, but it's the only way it can be done. So having a CV that, if I'm asking for leadership skills, good communication skills, experience in social media and project planning skills, if I don't see those words in the first half of that page, you're not going to get that. Got them buried in page two or three, or as you say, I've got to work it out from the nuances of what you've written. And then you get down to perhaps 20, then they might get read in a little bit more detail, because now I've got to get down to six to interview and so on and so on. So a CV is a calling card. It's got to get that foot in the door. You won't get the job with a CV, you'll get the job with an interview.
That's really interesting. So what skills do you think you learn through the RAF and through working in the charity sector that are really applicable to your role now within the Nutrition Society?
I think the first one, of course, would be leadership. Not just understanding the principles of it, but living with it and being responsible for delivering leadership for so long. That just becomes part of who you are. And that enables you to adapt to a range of different opportunities, particularly the training that you get. And then I guess the other two down from that then, more specific, would be an understanding of strategy. I mean, how important being able to think strategically is. Then planning, because there's no point having a strategy if you can't put a plan to go with it. But lastly, and I think the one that really has struck me in the last few years, teamwork. It's bringing together the right people and then developing them, not just as a team, but developing them as individuals, empowering them, which I've been doing for 6.5 years. I mean, we've had some mistakes, but we've now got a team of 12. And I can honestly say I've never worked with such a great group of people before. They are all the right people in the right place at the right time. The energy you get from that and the sense of self-satisfaction that you get at the end of the day, because you're serving those people. Leadership is about serving. And again, another piece I guess I picked up in the military, the idea of the servant leader. Look after everybody first, then look after yourself. Because if you've looked after everybody else, they're more likely to turn around and look after you in return. So it becomes a reciprocal arrangement.
That's really amazing. And I wrote down some really good words there, the key to adapt. My question comes actually on the teamwork one, and it's quite applicable to today. With COVID-19 and the pandemic, everything's gone online. And for someone like myself who started my master's this year, I'm doing lots of teamwork projects, which have been amazing. And I love a team project. However, they're all online now and we've never met in person. Do you have any advice for helping us navigate the new world of being online, especially when we've not met people in person?
Yeah, that probably is the challenge of the day, isn't it? That remoteness. And people are saying that home working is the new way to go. And I honestly don't believe it. We closed our office down in mid-March, everybody else. But by the 1st of September, at the first chink of opportunity, everybody came back. I didn't make it compulsory, but I said I need to come back. And within that first week or so, we were getting things done in hours that were taking days to do online, because you get that energy when you can be in a room with people and you can bounce ideas around rather than talking over each other or waiting your turn or putting your hand up. So I think in terms of the team, there's a saying in leadership, one of the principles of leadership is needs. And if you think of three metal rings that are all joined together, one of those puzzles that you used to try and pull the rings apart, you know, one ring is the needs of the individual. The other one is the needs of the team, and the other one is the needs of the task. And as a leader, you've got to look after those three sets of needs all the time. And the reason those rings are joined together is you can't isolate one of those, because the team is delivering the task, the individuals are contributing to the team, and so it goes around. So online, what I've been doing, certainly over the last few months, is we used to have weekly Zoom meetings as a team. And then we would have a second weekly Zoom meeting to have a cup of coffee, and we would have cake, and then somebody would take it in turns to host it, and there would be quizzes and games and those kind of things. That was okay for a while, but that began to fall a little bit flat. And when we went into the second lockdown, I now spend more time doing one-to-ones rather than with the team. And I'm finding that the team is stronger because I'm looking at the needs of the individual as well as the needs of the team. And that's about as good as it can get with distant teams. Mm-hmm. And perhaps varying the format. Sometimes you get fed up with people looking into your house. So make it a telephone call, not a Zoom call. And then I go to different rooms in the house. Luckily, I have a garden. And in the good weather, I would go and sit outside and make the telephone call. Anything just to break it up a little bit. But focus on the individual, I think, can get lost when you see the little squares on the screen and everybody's collaborating. You've got to balance that with individuals.
That's really great advice. Thank you. And yes, it's definitely been tough. But I think, as you've highlighted before, and I'd like to say again, we're all like adapting together to the new situation and new circumstances. Regarding the Nutrition Society, what makes you really excited to start your day at work?
Immediately comes to mind is the team again. It's the people, having that great team of people around, and we're a good family. And the second part, not related to that, but as somebody who loves history and the military, this year is the 80th anniversary of the Nutrition Society. So to be able to be associated with something that is that old yet has stood the test of time, and to know that in the archives, in our history boxes, and I will have made a contribution to that. And the contribution then that Nutrition Society makes to the country and to the world with its research and its members. And I've had even the slightest positivity around that. That to me makes it so worthwhile. This task, this opportunity just seems very natural. And it doesn't seem like getting up in the morning is any different to any other day. It is about the Nutrition Society and the team and the members and the science and the influence that we're hopefully having around the world.
It's amazing to hear you speak about it like that. I also wanted to say, I mean, when I first asked you about what do you love about the Nutrition Society, the first thing that you said was the team, and what a sign of an amazing leader. I think that's an absolutely incredible thing. And I mean, it highlights the values of the Nutrition Society. I'm going to have to flip that question on its head, though. And for you, what is the biggest challenge within your work?
Well, there are a couple. There isn't one single one. One big challenge is the change to the publishing landscape and the shift to open access. Mm-hmm. So the Nutrition Society, about 80% of its revenue comes from the selling of its journals. And then that money is reinvested in conferences and summer studentships and grants and all those kind of things. And for 80 years, people have subscribed, individuals have subscribed, universities, institutions have subscribed to journals. Open access moves that the other way. And of course, as you know, you now have to pay to publish. So our traditional funding model is going through a transformation, and nobody quite knows what that's going to look like. So it's a very nervous time of the society's history. So a lot of work is being done. We had a trustee meeting last week where we spent a lot of time looking 2 years ahead, trying to predict what the funding situation is going to look like. So finances is always a concern. I think the other one is also part of the problem of being so old. 80 years, lots of tradition, lots of history. We are very much a traditional scientific learned society. And there's great value in having history and tradition, but how do you become contemporary for today's audience without losing that history? Now, we have 2,800 members now. 1,000 of those are students. About 300 live all over the world. There's 1,000 in the UK and Europe. And just within those 1,000 in the UK and Europe, the youngest is 26, the oldest is 96. How do you deliver something with that age range, with that different need? And that's a constant challenge. It's not one that's ever going to beat me, because we're always looking for ways to improve. We're about to publish in the next couple of months our new 5-year strategic plan. And a big part of it is that moment I had a couple of months ago when I realized this is the 80th anniversary. So it's not a, you do something on the 50th and the 75th. The next big anniversary is going to be the 100th anniversary. So that's 20 years from now. People like you and your demographic, you will be the leaders of the Nutrition Society in 20 years. So what are we doing now to prepare you for that, to help you on that journey, to get you ready for those opportunities to lead the society around the world and be the voice of nutrition? And that's now going to be in the strategic plan. We don't have the answers to that yet, but that's the focus now for the next 5 years. Great opportunities, huge challenges, but wow, that gets you out of bed in the morning. We've got to have multiple voices and multiple focuses in a time in history where communication is coming at us left, right, and center all over the place. And we've got to be heard in that noise. So we've got to find our voice, but it's got to be more than one voice. That, to me, is probably our biggest challenge.
Wow. It's very interesting to see what goes on behind the scenes of the Nutrition Society. And I mean, I have a great appreciation for what you do, and it sounds very interesting. As someone who's not a nutritionist yourself, but has a very different background, what have you learned from the members of the Nutrition Society?
Scientifically, I have learned the value of the evidence base, the fact that evidence has to underpin everything. And I'd never really probably appreciated that as a non-scientist up to the point that I joined the society. But I now apply that concept of evidence across a whole range of my work. You know, I'm always asking, well, where's the story behind that? Where's the evidence behind that? Where's the proof of that? And of course, during my time over the last 6.5 years has been that explosion of fake news as well. And social media being dominated in nutrition by, you know, people who've done a 10-day correspondence course and now they're a super duper nutritionist and they're giving out advice and there's no evidence behind it. And how do you challenge that? So I've really appreciated the evidence base and the skills that people bring to the table in developing that thought process and not compromising on it. That's why I enjoy spending so much time with the members, because they are quite unique in the country as scientists.
Exactly. And I think you've actually highlighted one of the biggest challenges within the work of nutrition. And as a nutritionist myself, I think the evidence base is so important. Referencing yourself is so important, making sure that you know the literature, you know what's new, and also developing my skills to be able to overcome that with the evidence is so important.
I think the great opportunity for today's young nutritionists is if they can be morally courageous to stand up and challenge, to ask for the evidence. And that is incredibly difficult, because if you are challenging somebody who's got 100,000 followers and they all turn on you on Twitter, that's a very uncomfortable place to be. But it's the right thing to do. And if you do the right thing for the right reasons, you will never go wrong. And the more of you who can collaborate around that. There was a group a couple of years ago called Fight the Fads. It was 6 from King's College London. And they got together. Every time they saw something that wasn't right, they challenged it, but they challenged it as a group. So they came together, had collective strength. It was very good to see. I don't know if they're still around. I probably should Google them and see if they're still. But yeah, they did great work, but there just wasn't enough of them. And I know it must be really difficult when, I mean, it's happened to me, people occasionally turn on you. So there's a lot to be said for standing up. And it is the function of, as I was saying earlier, the next generation of leaders to take a stand.
And I think you saying how you need courage and you've got to know your reading, know where you're coming from. And my advice to our listeners, if you're in that kind of position, is to go to other people who are maybe slightly more experienced than yourself, because there are amazing nutritionists and dietitians on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook who have more experience doing it, and maybe talk to them, ask for their advice. I just wanted to ask you a bit of your advice, because I mean, you've got a lot of experience within leadership and with people at the beginning of their nutrition journeys, and they're looking for interning, they're looking for volunteering. What advice would you have to help them gain experience?
Well, firstly, I wouldn't be afraid to look outside the immediate world of nutrition. One of the very strong candidates we had a couple of years ago had been heavily involved in the Girl Guide movement. She'd taken the UK contingent to the Japan annual Girl Guiding Jamboree, and that showed enormous leadership skills, planning skills, communication skills, interpersonal skills. And it was buried on the second page of her CV. And you need to look for those opportunities, because the difference at that early stage when you're trying to get that interview, as I've mentioned earlier on the CV, is having something that nobody else is doing or not many people have done. Out of those 100 CVs, 80 of those will look almost exactly the same. They will all talk about their university, the course they've done, the research they've done, but it doesn't talk about what skills have they brought. And that's where volunteering, helping out, and think of what you could do in a food bank, what you could do in your neighborhood, blogs you could write, calling up people just to have a chat with them. And all of that can be twisted in a CV to the right type of language around communication and teamwork and project planning and leadership. Those are the words that will get you jobs and experience in those. It's those who take a step back and say, actually, what can I learn today on YouTube? Or can I sign up for an online course? Can I broaden my skills beyond nutrition? Which makes your CV naturally more interesting. And then from a networking point of view, it makes it a little bit easier to network because you have a broader range of interests.
Definitely thinking outside the box and adapting to the situation that you're in. I think one of the questions that I was going to ask you was, so during the pandemic, it has been possible to find some experience. What's not been possible is actually that shadowing experience, that going into hospitals, that seeing nutrition and dietetics in practice. That has not happened for the safety of the trust. But what I found is watching people online on IGTVs answering questions, seeing how they explain nutrition in evidence-based terms, but that's easy to understand and that's relatable and that can apply to everyone's everyday lives. So that's in a diet that you enjoy, that's sustainable for you. I think that's been the best experience that I've had. But do you have any advice or any thoughts on what we can do for the current demographic that haven't been able to get that actual hands-on shadowing experience?
It's very easy, I guess, for me to say this, but I wouldn't worry too much about it. It's a year and it will catch up. The key is positioning yourself so that you're at the front of the queue when this happens. And I'll give you an example. Back in late November, early December, I gave a Zoom talk and I spoke about the Nutrition Society and what we do. And I got asked a question about internships. And I said, well, unfortunately, normally we have a couple a year. And unfortunately, of course, at the moment, it would be quite difficult to offer internships remotely. But when we open up again, yes. And there's no structure to it. You email me and say you're interested and you perhaps put a CV on there and you tell me what skills you're looking to gather. And then when an opportunity comes up and I'm looking for somebody who wants to learn communication skills and I've got a communications project coming up, I zip into my folder and I pull out a couple of people and I ring them up and say, are you still interested in the internship? At the end of that talk, I said, so if you're interested, just email me. Out of 105, how many do you think emailed me? One out of 105 people. So the secret is that person took action. They were courageous enough to say, I want to be your intern. So that person is now at the front of the queue. We do have one virtual intern at the moment, and she's based in Hong Kong. But she wrote in cold and said, I've got a couple of months spare. I'm looking for some experience in this. I'm willing to help. And she is doing a little bit of research around international scientists for us, building us a database of very senior academics and what their specialization is in case we're looking for speakers in those areas. And that's now on her CV. That's something nobody else is doing. So get to the front of the queue, be bold, be courageous. And I wouldn't personally worry about it. If you're doing the right things, opportunity will come your way.
Being proactive. So I guess we're coming to the end of the podcast. I just have a couple more questions for you. At the beginning, I asked you, where did your first interest in nutrition come from? So I just wanted to ask you, how has your inspirations changed over your experience at the Nutrition Society?
As a non-nutritional scientist, the deal is that I don't talk publicly ever about nutrition. But from a layman's perspective, I'm certainly seeing a shift to the society, certainly being more broadly interested. It used to be about research. Now it is also much more focused on the application of the nutrition science, not just the research. And that opens up a whole range of opportunities for people to become involved. I think the other thing is the interest that seems to be being shown increasingly in nutrition is not standing on its own in terms of a science. The society is collaborating with, you know, the gut microbiologists and the World Obesity Federation. So nutrition being seen part as of the health and lifestyle approach. So as a layperson, we look at it holistically. Mm-hmm. It's running, it's exercise, it's food, it's drink, it's relaxation, it's mindfulness, it's relationships, it's people. And trying to keep all of that together during COVID, of course, is really challenging,
really,
which I think when we come out of it, I think all of those things, we will have a greater appreciation for than we had before. So I think seeing nutrition in the whole, there isn't a single solution to everything.
And from a nutritionist perspective, that comes back to me as having a balanced, sustainable diet. But remembering you don't have to do it all, and you do not have to do it all the time. Just doing what you can and what you enjoy. And within nutrition, the different professions that are coming together as part of a multidisciplinary team.
Probably one of the most, I think, fastest growing and perhaps most exciting career opportunities that hasn't quite hit us yet, that's out there, is science communications. Mm-hmm. 2 years ago, Nutrition Society didn't have a science communicator. Now we do. And that's a cross-disciplinary opportunity. You don't have to be a nutritionist to be a science communicator. But if you are, then there's opportunities for you in all of those health-related opportunities. Because as long as you understand science and the evidence base of science, and you can talk about it and relate it and write about it and talk and film, then that's a great career opportunity. It's the sort of thing you could call an organization and say, do you have a science communicator? Because that's what I'm thinking of doing. And if they don't, you could say, well, let me volunteer for you a couple of days a week, or do some work for you on your website. And then suddenly they realize the value of it. And then you've created a job for yourself. That's an extreme example, but that's sometimes how it happens. Yeah. Back to proactive again. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So just two more questions for you, Mark. So firstly, what is next for you and your journey within the Nutrition Society?
Leadership development, I think, for me is the next big thing. A couple of years ago, I was invited on International Women's Day to go to Leeds University and give a lecture on women in leadership. And it was one of the best days of my past 6 years. And out of that experience of researching men and women, that there is no difference. Leadership is leadership. So I committed 2 years ago to finding a way of building a leadership development program in the society, specifically for women, and finding a way of getting that into people's careers at an early stage. And this is the year we're starting that development process. I've written a lot of the background material for it, but is it going to be a blended learning experience? Are we going to do perhaps a couple of residential weekends? Are we going to do an online course, webinars? All of that work's now got to be done because obviously there's a cost implication. But my ambition is that hundreds of people per year can get some basic leadership training skills for their professional life. They can do with those skills whatever they want. As long as they're adaptable, we'll give them the tools.
Sounds amazing and really exciting. Could you sum up for us, please, in a sentence, a few words or a quote, any advice that you would give to people career-wise currently on their journey in nutrition?
I would give you a quote if I can. Mm-hmm. And apologies that it's from an older generation, but it's a quote from Winston Churchill. It's going back to courage. And he said, success is not final. Failure is not fatal. It's the courage to continue that counts. And I think that just about sums up actually where we are in the world at the moment. I've had lots of success in my life and I've had more than my fair share of failure. It's that ability to pick yourself up and keep going, the courage to continue to get more success. And there will be more failure, there'll be more success. And that's what keeps us going.
Thank you, Mark, for sharing your advice and joining me today to share your journey and experience with us. If anyone would like to find you, they can find you on Twitter by searching for NS_CEO, your personal website, www.markhollingsworth.org, and the Nutrition Society website by searching for www.nutritionsociety.org. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Mark, for joining me today. It is clear how passionate you are about leadership and the Nutrition Society, and I have a great appreciation for what you do. I have learned so much about leadership, including the importance of teamwork, courage, communication, planning, and adaptability, and that when looking for work experience, to not be afraid to look outside the box and broaden your skill set. And thank you to all of you listening, joining me on the journey of this podcast. If you love hearing about others' journeys as much as I love to share them, please give this podcast a 5-star review. It will help us reach more people. I wish Mark and all of you luck on your journeys. I hope you join me soon for the second half of the season to discover more journeys in nutrition.